right? People don't call 911 because they've had their best day. They call 911 because their situation has exceeded their problem-solving skills and they are in crisis. Sadly enough is like the people coming to help you are in crisis as well. And so they're just juggling so much. Like we need to get them in the best mindset so they can handle their stuff, but then they can help the people that are in crisis that need it so much when they call emergency services for help.
Hi, I'm Bob Mathers, and welcome to The Growth Mixtape, a podcast where I talk to the most interesting people you might not have come across yet. I find that these conversations give me new insights and perspectives about topics I didn't know existed. These conversations might not seem to have a lot in common at first, but just like songs and a mixtape, they create something memorable and emotional. Today we talk to Nicole Ferry, a 26-year veteran of law enforcement who's on a mission to help others build resilience by sharing her heartbreaking stories of PTSD, trauma, and suicide. Nicole is best known for her talk, What the Hell? The Three Things I Learned in the Worst Year of My Life. Nicole has spent her life in law enforcement. She holds a degree in criminal justice. She's been an executive police leader for a railroad. She did an 8-year tour as a military police officer and is a graduate of the FBI National Academy in Quantico, Virginia. Now, I don't have any direct experience with PTSD any more than I know what it's like to get a yellow brick from the FBI or investigate deaths on America's railways. But I felt Nicole's stories in my bones. This conversation is a roller coaster. It's heavy material, but we also laughed a lot, mostly as I tried to relate Nicole's stories to my only frame of reference, Law & Order, A Few Good Men, and Bro Cop movies set in Boston. Nicole's brave stories carry a message of resilience and hope. But most importantly, they're a reminder of how much we can learn from those with dramatically different experiences from our own. So please enjoy Nicole Ferry. Welcome, Nicole Ferry, to the podcast. I'm genuinely looking forward to this conversation, and I'm really grateful for you joining today.
Thank you, Bob.
Just a little bit of context for this conversation. You and I met, I don't know, it feels like maybe 6 months or so ago at a thing called Heroic Public Speaking, which is a bit of a workshop for people that want to invest in public speaking. And during the course of that, the facilitator invited people up to the stage for a little bit of lightning coaching. And the instructions were just, hey, come up and deliver a couple of lines, and then he would provide some coaching. And I don't know whether you were the first person to get up, but you were definitely one of the first. And you spoke something to the effect that you're in law enforcement and police officers are more likely to die by suicide than they are by getting killed in the line of duty. And that really struck a chord with me. And I probably heard 20 or 25 people get up over the course of those 2 days and get coached on that stage. And I got to say, yours is the only one that I remember. So that when I was later putting together this podcast, I'm like, I got to reach out to Nicole and have this conversation. So I just wanted to set that kind of that stage for you, because that's how we ended up here.
Yeah. Absolutely. So thank you, Bob. When we went to Heroic Public Speaking, I had a national conference appearance within a couple weeks. And so my anxiety was pretty high to make sure that I had what I needed to confidently go out there and give my speech. And so I usually had started my speech with, you know, I'm more likely to kill myself than to be killed in the line of duty. And they helped me craft that so that I don't lose my audience really at the beginning, and help me craft that message. And so I'm incredibly grateful. I've had a few opportunities because of that little 5 minutes that I got to present my piece and then get the coaching after that. Unfortunately, suicide and mental health is it's universal, right? It doesn't know any age, gender, religious type. It knows no bounds. And so it touches a lot of people. And so that's what I'm hoping to do is have a positive impact on first responders, military, and their families specifically, on how we can go from a culture of a vow of silence and sacrifice and selflessness, move into a culture of more openness and connection to be able to have those tough conversations. We're willing to we're quite literally willing to die for one another, but we are not willing to have tough conversations that are willing to save our lives.
Yeah, that's, I mean, that's so fascinating. I was doing a little bit more research on you and your story, obviously, in preparation for this conversation and some of the roles that you've had. And you talk very openly, obviously, about your experience with suicide and specifically also being a sexual assault investigator. And so just be honest, like this is a very, I don't really know how to have conversations like this, right? So I don't want to be insensitive. I don't want to ask stupid questions. And so the idea of this podcast was always really to have conversations, you know, way outside our comfort zone. And I cannot think of a conversation more outside my comfort zone, but I guess that really is the point, right? To allow people to have those conversations and not have traumatic consequences down the road.
Yeah, absolutely. So the ability to be more vulnerable and let people in so that you know that you're not alone, but they also know that they're not alone in struggle. So as humans, we're wired to struggle. It's one of the things that we are as humans is just wired to struggle in our community as first responders. And that first responder community is police, fire, emergency medical technicians, dispatchers, corrections, even nurses can fall into that first responder role. So all these people have very high stress jobs, very life or death. The decisions that they make in the moment are precision decisions that can impact people's lives. And we do this at such a rate without processing it that it becomes something that is stacked upon each other. And so you start to compartmentalize a lot of what happens to you during a day. And so that, as well as I have experience in the military, and I went into the military at 17 years old. So I have, that's essentially where I started. And so I have had multiple different roles. I was a military police officer in the military and transitioned to a municipal police department. I worked in a few different towns within the place that I call home. And then after a bit of time, I moved to private policing for a railroad. And that was one of the Class 1 railroads. So in Canada, you have CN. So there's, I worked for a large railroad, which had their own police department. So I'll hop back. The sexual assault investigator, I did that for 10 years at a municipal police level. And my job was to investigate any crime that was committed against anyone that had a sexual intent in nature. So that could be anything from rapes, assaults, that was on everything from infants and children to elderly, and everything in between. I did it before cell phones were a thing, and then I did it after cell phones are a thing in social media and the internet. So it was, that was a different way of turning sex into a business, sex into a crime. And so I investigated that for a long time. That took a very large toll on me, but compartmentalized, you push that down and went on to the, you know, the next job. To go back to the railroad, which was my last position, my role there was a special agent in charge. And so I was an executive police leader who led a team that policed 10 different states in one province of Canada. And so that was essentially all of the New England states of the U.S. and then the one province of Canada. And that would be anything from theft of railroad property, trespassing. We handled all of the death investigations. We helped secure infrastructure. So that was anything from the hazmat that was coming through on those trains or the bridges and tunnels that the trains went through. I know that was a really long answer.
No, No. I was going to ask you about that journey, and I just want to come back to a couple of things that you mentioned there. By the way, I'm, you know, in full disclosure of setting your expectation for some stupid questions here. This is a world that is very foreign to me. I don't have anybody in my family, even going back a couple of generations, that I know of that has been in first responders. So my knowledge of this, when you talk about military police, I think of A Few Good Men.
Yeah.
When you talk about sexual assault investigators, I think of Law and Order Special Victim Unit. Like, that's all I know about this world is TV and television. So, which I imagine is probably not all that uncommon, just for some context around, you know, where I'm coming from, which is very different than the audiences that you speak to, of course. But as you said, these issues are universal. You're coming to these conversations, obviously, with very specific experiences, and you talk a lot to first responders, but I mean, there's nobody really that hasn't been touched by some of these issues or will be probably over their lifetime.
Absolutely.
So back when you talked about how you got started in this, and you know, it's just interesting. One of my friends is going to be, you know, going through to be a firefighter. And so it's very kind of personal and recent for me because I think about some of those things that a firefighter would see and experience, you know, being first on scene at, you know, traffic accidents or, you know, fires, et cetera. And mm-hmm. I just think, oh my God, like I cannot imagine wanting my son or daughter to do that. And that's a very selfish thing because I know somebody has to do it. And I just admire so much the people that do it. But how do you get started in something like that? Because it does seem to me to be something that, at least again, from movies, right? From Boston, well, your dad was a cop and your grandfather was a cop. So you're going to be a cop and your brother's a cop and probably one of them got killed because that's how the story goes. But how do you get started in this line of work?
Yeah. So mine is a unique story. There's nobody in my family, my mom, dad, brother, sisters, we don't come from a family of first responders. And so that was unique for me to move outside of that. Both my parents were entrepreneurs. They both had owned businesses. When I was going through school, I was determined that I had dyslexia and a learning disability. Wasn't given very much help for that disability. And when it was time to take our standardized test to go to college, the SATs, I didn't do very well. And in our senior year of high school, while everyone was meeting with the guidance counselor over which college they were going to, when it was my turn to meet with the guidance counselor, he told me, you know, you're too stupid to go to college. You need to figure something else out. And that's a direct quote. So you're too stupid to go to college. You need to figure something else out. And so that didn't leave me with a whole lot of options or like, hey, we're gonna work on this together or anything. And so I had known a person that was in the class before me that had joined the National Guard. My grandfather, who had since passed for quite some time, was a military police officer in the Army in World War II. And so I was like, I guess I'll just join the National Guard. And 2 weeks later, I signed the paperwork and I sign up and become a part of the Massachusetts National Guard. While I'm still in high school, one weekend a month, I go and I play Army until I leave for boot camp to get my official training. And I go from a place of like not belonging in high school because everyone else was going to college. They had these big plans. And immediately I go into the military and I have a uniform that has my name on it. It was an automatic sense of belonging when I joined the military. I think looking back on it, I had always had somewhat of a leadership drive. It was the grit that I was given growing up. And so had fallen into a leadership position or chosen for leadership positions in the military and then at the police department, because I had that ability to communicate with people, get them to believe in the mission and what we were trying to accomplish, and then be able to break that down.
Yeah, interesting. One of the things I've been thinking about as I look back on some of the experiences in my life too, as you were mentioning your conversation with that guidance counselor, he or she wouldn't even remember them. It was just a one line, "You're too stupid to go to college," that changes your life and changes how you feel about yourselves and all the possibilities in front of you. 10 minutes before that conversation, there was no limit to what you could do. And all of a sudden, this was the only thing that you had, and how, mm-hmm. how those experiences can kind of shape it. And they don't seem that impactful at the time, but they change the course of our lives. So that's so interesting. I'm sure everybody can look back and relate to something like that.
Yeah. It was such an innocuous conversation, right? Like I had remembered that he had said that to me. So it was something that I used in job interviews. Like, tell me there was a time when you had to overcome adversity. And it was like, "Hey, I was told I was too stupid and I've accomplished all these things. I went to Johns Hopkins University. Mm-hmm. I was nominated to go to the FBI National Academy, and only 1% of the world's police leadership get to go to this class. Like, I have a master's." I had all these things. And it wasn't until I finished my master's, after all of, essentially my education was over, I looked back and said, I have this difference between achievement and fulfillment. And I kept driving for achievement to prove this individual decades earlier what he had said to me, that it wasn't true, and had to learn how to let go of that so that I could be happy with and fulfilled with what I had, but successful today in light of all of that.
Absolutely. Amazing. So you mentioned a couple of things I just want to come back to. One, just very quickly, in the spirit of asking stupid questions. So is going to the FBI Academy at Guantanamo like you see in the movies? Like, what is that experience like?
Yeah. So I was nominated to go to the FBI at Quantico, Virginia, not Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. So I don't want people to think that to jail.
There you go. I promised you stupid questions. Yes. I promised you stupid questions.
Yeah. So I did not go to international prison, although there's plenty of time for that.
Right.
No, I was nominated to go to the FBI's National Academy. We lived there for about 10 weeks. And we take classes from the University of Virginia right there at Quantico about police leadership, emotional intelligence, spiritual well-being, mental well-being. We also hear from lots of different people who have gone through tragedy and how they persevered and then how that impacted their life. That's when I went to the FBI. I didn't work for the FBI. It was just a course that I went to, and it's a very strong group of classmates that stick together, and they were from all over the world.
I know, of course, I've never been there, but I imagine the big FBI logo on the floor and you walking through security and walking through, I don't know whether that's true or not, but I just imagine you walking over that emblem and coming that far. Anyway, that's the movie version of it that I imagine in my head was as you walking through those big doors.
Yeah. So there is the big logo when you walk in the front door. There's so many layers of security even to get to the front door of the training center at Quantico. But I think it's finally when you graduate and you get to meet the director of the FBI and he hands you your diploma and your certificate. Yeah, they give you a yellow brick. It is the reason why you're there, is to have that brick. And once you get that yellow brick, you're like, things are good. So,
right.
But it does have some TV, it has some TV parts to it. So you're not wrong.
Well, I appreciate you being accommodating or understanding of my ridiculous questions. And I also wanted to come back to this railroad police thing. So mm-hmm. I've never heard of that. I guess I just assumed that if there was something that happened on a train, that there would be the police force for that jurisdiction would take control of it. What's the deal with railroad law enforcement?
I want to say uneducatedly that started in the U.S. And so a couple hundred years ago, when they started having issues, when the railroad was driving from east to west and they were meeting in the middle, they were losing a lot of product that was being shipped. They also had a lot of criminals that were on horseback and trying to steal from the rail. So there's Jesse James and the Sundance Kids and like all these different gangs that would hit the railroad. And there's some folklore about that, but railroads were starting to complain about the level of theft that was happening. And they were able to take a couple police officers and essentially give them policing jurisdiction. And the badge that I wore at the time very much looked like a U.S. Marshal badge. And that was kind of like a nod back to how we got started with the Pinkertons and how that happened. Sadly enough, that hasn't really evolved too much in a couple hundred years of legislations and different laws. And the train is still targeted for crime. When you talk about, you think that the locals will handle whatever has come up. Trains are so heavy and so dangerous that it is an interesting place to work. And many times first responders don't know what they're dealing with. And so usually when you get hired as a police officer for the railroad, a special agent, they give you special training on how to operate safely around trains. And that's what you're doing when you come on scene, is you're helping those local police departments, fire departments, EMS, really know how, you know, like, stand here, don't stand there. This is really unsafe. This isn't, God forbid that there's a derailment or something that has, you know, some hazmat with it. And doing that job, there was nothing really the same. Every day is different.
Wow. Yeah. I had no idea that was a thing. So far, my adolescent knowledge of your world through TV and movies isn't that far off. And when you're describing your journey through this, so it seems like, you know, your career is progressing as you might have, you know, expected it would. You're getting leadership positions, you're getting promoted, you're moving around and doing cooler things. But something happened in May, I think, of 2022 that sort of changed everything. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So as all of this has come up, May of 2022, I was in the middle of starting a wellness support team. And that was essentially just so that we could have the ability to support our agents that were doing more with less, that we're starting to see a lot of mental stress, a lot of burnout. And so this was something that I had been very passionate for years about, that something's coming down the pike. We're about to hit that critical incident. On the railroad in safety, we had like the smaller incidents that lead up to this big tragedy. And that's what happened to us in May of 2022. May 11th, one of the agents that works for me died by suicide in front of his partner on duty. And I had tried to help this individual the week up to this event and felt very responsible. That was absolute tragedy and something that I was trying very hard to prevent.
And so how do you deal with that at the time?
Yeah, as a leader, there are many things that have to be done on a whole host of different things. There's an investigation that has to be done. There's people that need to be taken care of. There's mental health issues that have to be dealt with. There's so many moving parts, a family, a funeral, and the fact that trains are continuing to move. And after that, I had found that I had really become a terrorist at home. I felt very responsible for the death. I felt responsible that I was not able to do more for the team that was still here. When I say I was a terrorist at home, I was at the whim of my emotions, right? I would come home hollering and screaming. I had stopped cooking. I had stopped cleaning. I was a nightmare to live with. To be quite honest, my family was just a burden that was getting in the way of me trying to serve this team because they needed me. Every 3 hours, someone gets hit by a train in our country. And each one of those, for the most part, have DVR footage. We have to watch that footage. And sometimes we have to watch that footage multiple times. And so not only do you see the back end of what it looks like when a train hits a person, but then you go and you watch it happen and you get to hear it happen because you know, it has audio as well. So all of these things, they're just overflowing now. My compartmentalization, my ability to dissociate is not good. I'm not sleeping. I'm not eating. I have nightmares and night terrors and night sweats. I have chronic pain. I had back surgery in 2018. I was having migraines. It was pretty dire. My hypervigilance was pretty high. I wouldn't go anywhere without being armed. It got very, very dark. And so I was trying to get to a point where I could get the partner that had witnessed the suicide to get help. So the interest in being a good leader, I was like, I'm going to go to treatment and I'm going to show them that they can go to treatment and that they can come back and things will be fine. And so I'm working with the partner. This is what I'm going to do. And I head to California. I go to a trauma treatment facility that is for first responders called First Responder Wellness. And I'm there for 30 days. And I get really upset because I tried to lead myself through trauma treatment, which is very interesting. I was like, you got to clean your room and you got to do this. And like, I ran it like a military operation. And these people were sick. Some of them had addictions to alcohol. And, you know, this may have been their first time that they had slept in a decade or something, that this is the first time they were clean in X amount of time. And so it was very interesting to me. It was about 30 days when I stopped leading everyone around in treatment, and 30 days became 60, and 60 became 90, and 90 became 120, and 120 came 142 days. So I spent 4.5 months in a trauma treatment facility. My hope, my wish, my thoughts were that I was always going back to my role, my position. I only had done this to show other people that it could be done. And so I really thought that I was doing such a service that I was going to be able to come back and talk about what it's like to get, you know, go through trauma and then come back to work. And so I did go back to work. I went back for a month and a half and was taken back out of work due to my increased symptoms again. And so the psychiatrist and therapist took me back out. And I had exhausted all of my short-term disability and onto long-term disability, and then had gone on some medicine. So this gets to the juicy part of it. So the psychiatrist decides that she's going to try a new medicine because the one I'm on doesn't work. And within a couple days, I'm not able to get out of bed. And my vision starts to come from the outside, and it starts to come in, and it's fuzzy around the edges. And every so often you can realize that it's getting slower and like it's closing in. And at that time I had to bring my daughter to the bus stop and come back. Like that was my only thing I had to do during the day, but I really couldn't get out of bed. And it was a really dark, dark time. And I had done that for a couple days, and I had gotten a phone call from my sister early one morning, just on a whim, and I had snapped. I had yelled at her, and I started screaming, and I realized like this was it. Like I am just done feeling this way. I don't know how I'm gonna feel any different. I have lost my job. I've lost my career. I've lost my friend. Like there's nothing. I'm so alone in this, and I just can't do this anymore. And I go and I bring my daughter to the bus stop. I give her a hug and a kiss, and I tell her I love her, and I say goodbye to her. And that was the last time I was going to see my daughter. So I watch her get out of my car and go up the stairs on the bus. And I decide that when I get home, I'm going to kill myself. And And that was the last time that I was going to see her. And I slowly drove away from the bus stop and pulled into the driveway. And in this strange feeling, like I looked up into the rearview mirror and there was like a flash of white. And that was my husband pulling into the driveway. So my sister had called my husband and said that I was screaming on the phone, and then he was able to make it. He shouldn't have been able to make it where he was to home in that time, but he made it in home in time, and we were able to call the right people and get to a point where they could realize that I was having a reaction. The side effects to that particular medicine was eye pressure. Also the suicidal ideation, but with the eye pressure and making everything go dark, like everything really was dark in my world. And so the two of them together were really powerful. And I had to be monitored to come off that because I couldn't come off of that altogether. So they slowly tapered that off and got me onto a different medication that I was able to tolerate better. And so that was last summer, and then started in more of the speaking realm. And that's where I met Bob, is that I had an opportunity to speak about my agent's suicide, and then the medication that I was on and my suicidal plan. Our silence is quite literally killing us. We're willing to die for each other. We're not willing to talk for each other. And so moving from that vow of silence to a culture that believes that we can talk about this and it be okay is now what my new mission of service is to tell people my story, let them ask me all the questions that they could possibly ask me, let them be human and ask questions without any judgment, and see if we can help people that way.
Wow, that's an incredible story, Nicole. I'm so grateful for you sharing it. It sounds when you tell that story that it was that suicide that basically just, it was the thing that broke everything. All this decompartmentalizing that you've been doing over the years and all the terrible things you've seen.
Yeah.
I am guessing that the goal now is to be able to have conversations from the very beginning so people don't just store this stuff up, because it is going to come out in a really terrible way if we don't have ways of having these conversations as you go.
Yes, absolutely. So I think you can use the analogy of it's a wheelbarrow and you put a rock in it, and then at some point it's going to get unstable and then you're going to drop the wheelbarrow. Or you can put it, putting rocks in your backpack. At some point you can't hold that weight anymore. And the suicide in May of 2022 was the final boulder in my, my backpack or my wheelbarrow. It literally spilled and hit everyone in my path. But if I could have had tools on the front half that made it okay to decompress, make it okay to talk about, make it okay, and give me some self tools, some self care tools that were just ingrained in me. Like professional athletes have mindset coaching now. It is it's very popular. If you're going to the Olympics soon, you have a mindset coach. Someone's training you on what your mind should be saying. It's positive mindset, it's growth mindset, it's a winning mindset. And if you're a professional athlete, you start this in high school and you practice it. So your 10,000 hours are accumulated very early on. Well, professionals in our world need to get this a whole lot earlier, and they need to do it consistently, and they need to train in self-care like they were a professional athlete, right? People don't call 911 because they've had their best day. They call 911 because their situation has exceeded their problem-solving skills and they are in crisis. What a lot of people, sadly enough, is like the people coming to help you are in crisis as well. And so they're just juggling so much. We need to get the people that are there to help. Like, we need to get them in the best mindset so they can handle their stuff, but then they can help the people that are in crisis that need it so much when they call emergency services for help.
Yeah, that's so much of what you said, it, you know, resonates, because I can't identify with many of the experiences you've had, but I think me and I got to believe our listeners can identify with this idea of the backpack, right? That it might not be people getting hit by trains and people committing suicide and all the terrible things you see, but we can feel the weight of those things that we accumulate through our lives, no matter what it is. You talked about vulnerability and we talked about mental health. This stuff has changed in the span of our lifetime. Like, I don't know what my dad did when he was feeling anxious or depressed. He probably had a drink, or maybe he would watch football, or, you know, he'd had nobody to talk to. It's just so amazing that when you've got people like you that are coming and sharing their story and normalizing all of this, because it seems to be changing pretty quickly. Are you seeing that in the military and law enforcement?
So we definitely are seeing different programs that are being installed in places. Some of them, quite frankly, are check the boxes. They're reactive because of something that has happened. They had a critical incident and they're doing something. There are a lot of programs now that are starting to catch on, right? Like, they're starting to put the officer's mental health on the top of the priority list. When you've had self-care and you are properly self-regulated as a human, you can help everyone around you. It is like being on an airplane when the airline attendant tells you, put your own mask on first before the elderly and the infants, because you can help them if you have proper oxygen yourself. But if you don't have your own oxygen, you're no good to the people around you that you need to help. Self-care is that same thing. There are a host of different things that you can do for self-care. It is very simple, but it's not easy. And it has to be done on a consistent manner. And so my self-care had to be a checklist of things that I have to do. I have to meditate for 20 minutes every day. No exceptions, right? I have to eat at least once a day, because at some of my sickest, I would go days without eating. So I have to eat at least one meal. Two is better. Three is amazing. But one is the minimum. I have to have one social interaction a day, something where I have a conversation back and forth. I have to move my body physically. If that's a 5-minute walk outside, or it's a quick yoga, like 5-minute yoga set of movements, it's got to be some kind of exercise where I move my body. I have to make sure that I'm sleeping, journaling, reading something that doesn't have to do with self-help or bettering myself. I have to do some reading on something outside of police work, self-help, something like that. And that I'm seeking my professional, that I'm making my doctor's appointments, that I'm making the commitment to whatever they're prescribing, that I am doing. Their prescription is not always medicine. It could be like, you know, stand in front of the mirror and tell yourself, I love you for 30 times for 30 days. And standing in front of that mirror going, I love you, I love you, I love you, and going, this sounds so stupid. I don't know why I'm doing this. And then a couple weeks in, you're like, that feels a little bit different. And then 3 weeks, it feels a little bit different. And so if I just went off the data from day one, I'd be like, this is ridiculous. But the consistency for it. So in my journal, I keep a checklist of all the things that I need to do. And those are the first things I get checked off to make sure that I can go to bed when I've had X amount of these things done.
Yeah, that's something that even, you know, I and my, you know, listening to you, my fairly mundane life, but yeah, that importance of routine. And I get up and I have my coffee, then I go for a run, then I do some yoga, then I do some meditating and reading and journaling, a lot of things that you mentioned too. And if something interrupts that and I miss, you know, number three and number six, I just don't feel right. One of the things that I just realized, because we talk about mental health and physical health, it's all the same thing. You can't have a healthy mind without a healthy body and vice
versa.
They're
all interconnected.
Yeah. And so I used to have this, well, I still do. I kind of have this model of how to keep everything in harmony in my life. It's work, friends and community, family, and now it's health, but it used to be physical health and mental health. So I used to have five quadrants, and then I'm like, these number four and five are not different. They're the same thing. But anyway, everybody's on that sort of journey and figuring out those things. And hopefully it doesn't come to a kind of a traumatic head like you. And
yeah,
with any luck, we sort of figure it out as we go.
I love your five quadrants.
Well, it keeps me being tolerable and functional. So, you know, who knows? They might change over time, and I'm open to that too. So I want to be respectful of your time. This has been a really powerful conversation, Nicole. I can't thank you enough for telling your story. Just finally, so what are you most excited about now?
So I'm excited now. I have a couple speaking engagements that are coming up. I'm speaking twice later this month at the FBI National Academy in Quantico, Virginia, not Guantanamo.
Yes.
And I'm the guest speaker at the Survive First Gala in April. And so I'm doing some speaking opportunities and also going to be launching a RISE program, which is an evidence-based mindful stress reduction program. And that's a certification that I have out of the local yoga place here, Kripalu Yoga and Health. And so I'm going to be doing a six-week module on how to self-regulate emotions and get the best out of yourself and helping yourself be calm and have some clarity and connection.
That's amazing. It's such an inspiring story. Thanks again for sharing it. I will include in the show notes links to a couple of the other podcasts that you've done. They've been really, really powerful. I just can't thank you enough. I'm so grateful for you sharing your story. I just want to acknowledge you and all of the amazing work you're doing. It's amazing. Thanks again, Nicole.
Thank you, Bob. I really appreciate it. If you want anything more, you can go to NicoleFerry.com.
The Growth Mixtape Podcast with Bob Mathers is produced by Bespoke Projects. Music by Jean-Michel Walter Cronkite. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to follow and rate us. When you do this, it helps to raise our podcast profile so that more people can find us. If you want to connect, you can find me on LinkedIn using the link in the show notes.